The following is an encore presentation that first aired on July 6, 2021. The segment with Austin Sanders in Part 2 is new and was recorded on March 18, 2022. This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on June 29th. From a December 2020 entry on the website of the American Bar Association. The substance of constitutional rights is meaningless if state actors can violate those rights with impunity. Such rights would become, in James Madison's words, parchment barriers, symbolic commitments to individual liberty that do nothing in practice to deter or prevent unlawful misconduct by government agents. Unfortunately, most members of law enforcement operate today in a culture of near-zero accountability. Police officers rarely face meaningful consequences for their misconduct, and the public's accurate perception of this fact has contributed to what can best be described as a crisis of confidence in our nation's law enforcement. Last month, an investigative report by Reuters analyzed appellate court records and noted that since 2005, the courts have shown an increasing tendency to grant immunity to law enforcement in excessive force cases. Furthermore, the trend appears to be accelerating, especially when civilians are unarmed. The report observed that even as the proliferation of police body cameras and bystander cell phone video has turned a national spotlight on extreme police tactics, qualified immunity, under the careful stewardship of the Supreme Court, is making it easier for officers to kill or injure civilians with impunity. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Beth Schwartzapfel, award-winning staff writer for the Marshall Project, which seeks to create and sustain a sense of national urgency regarding the U.S. criminal justice system. Their goal is to render that system more fair, effective, transparent, and humane. Last month, Beth co-authored an article in the Austin American Statesman that covers a particularly egregious case of police misconduct, which we will discuss this evening. And Jim Harrington is with us once again. He's the retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Michelle Manning Scott, the associate producer of this program, is with us too. Welcome, Beth, and thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a real privilege to have you here. Please tell us a little about your background and a little about the history and mission of the Marshall Project.
Sure. I'm a staff writer with the Marshall Project, and before the Marshall Project was founded in 2014, I worked as a freelance reporter for many years covering the criminal justice system. Back in the days when mentioning that you were a reporter covering prisons and jails would make people's eyes kind of widen in shock at a dinner party, to now where you mention it and pretty much everyone knows somebody who's either affected by our nation's enormous prison and jail complex, or know somebody who's working to dismantle it in some way, or working to make the system more fair in some way. oh, I have a niece who volunteers through her college, or I have a friend who, you know, runs a program in San Quentin. It seems that the last 10 or 15 years has really brought a sea change to our country's awareness of how big and unwieldy our punishment system has become. And I like to think the Marshall Project, we strive for fair and transparent and balanced journalism on the subject, has played a small part in that.
Well, great. That's really edifying. And again, it's wonderful to have you here. Jim, you've been involved with this topic for quite a while. Could you just tell our listeners a little more about your background?
Qualified immunity. I've actually practiced law enough to watch this evolve and become even more daunting and oppressive, I think, in terms of redress with respect to government actors. And, you know, got to the point, I think, that it's very clear that this has become pretty close to an absolute shield against redress with regard to police brutality, misconduct, killing, and the same thing for other government entities in prison. You know, we did a lot of prison litigation as well. It's really unfortunate, you know, and particularly in our state and in our circuit, the Fifth Circuit, it's an awful, awful hurdle. And I'm sure we'll get into reasons as we go along, but I'm happy to be here and talk about this. You know, I taught in law school for like 27 years in a seminar, and you could just watch this doctrine get worse and worse and worse until now it's almost a wall.
Could you or Beth talk about just what is qualified immunity? Maybe Beth, could you start off?
Sure. So qualified immunity began as a fairly reasonable concept, which is that during the civil rights movement, there was a landmark piece of legislation that basically said, you know, public officials needed to be held responsible for their actions. The Supreme Court stepped in the late 60s and said, yes, that's true, but they should also not fear bankruptcy for every good faith mistake they make. And so the Supreme Court came up with this idea of qualified immunity, that if a public official makes a mistake, but the mistake is in good faith, that they can't be sued. They have that sort of qualified shield against being sued for wrongdoing. Over the years, as Jim mentioned, qualified immunity has been taken to a farther and farther extreme, to the point that police officers routinely kill people, maim people, make really egregious mistakes, sometimes in good faith, and sometimes, who knows, you know, what their mindset was. And over again, the courts are granting them qualified immunity, arguing that the victims of their misconduct cannot sue them.
I want to follow up on what Beth said, because I think this is really important. There certainly is argument about protecting the public coffers, right? So that the taxpayers don't get zinged for egregious damages, even though they might be appropriate. And this would particularly be the case of punitive damages. But a rule that said, okay, we will limit this to actual damages that the victim have suffered, you know, so that the victim is made whole, or in the case of death, the family would be compensated. And so that, to me, would have been a much more just alternative than this blanket immunity that's conferred, to the point, I'm sure we'll talk about this in a minute, the absurdity of the application of the rule now about prior incidents. But I think this was established as a matter of policy by the court. There's some reason behind it for sure, but the court has refused to modify a rule so that there is justice in a particular situation. And the thing is, as Beth mentioned, we have to assume that when the officer says, well, I did this in good faith, that the officer did it in good faith and therefore is immune, even though in reality, there's a lot of question about the good faith that the officer used in that particular situation, or even whether the officer used bad faith. All you need is that allegation in the pleadings, and then all this protective mechanism trips in. And so the victim, in a sense, is doubly victimized by the police and victimized by the court system, by these rules that the court has created.
The court, too, not to get too much into the weeds this early in our conversation, but the court also uses this standard that is really dissociated from the real world. When they're deciding whether an officer should be liable for their mistake, They ask whether it was clearly established, whether the fact that the officer should not have done that was clearly established at the time that they did it. And their rule for whether something was clearly established or not is whether there is a court case in that particular district that has been published with very similar facts. And if that sounds really in the weeds, that's because it is. So one case that came up recently that illustrates just how absurd this is, there was a case in the Pacific Northwest, I think it was Seattle, but don't quote me on that, where there was a bystander who had a cell phone and was filming the police beating a suspect. And the police took the guy's phone and deleted, Jim, do you know the details? Did they delete the video or did they tell him he wasn't allowed to film?
Yeah, I think actually both.
Okay. Anyway, the police had been trained in their own training that bystanders have a First Amendment right to film them doing their jobs. So in all practical purposes, the police knew very well that taking this man's phone away, deleting the video was not allowed, that he was protected. However, because there was no court that had published an opinion saying that that was protected by the First Amendment, that bystanders can film them, they were not allowed to be sued for that. So that's just one example of how the courts use this very esoteric rule to show whether a cop should have known they're not allowed to do something. And that rule is pretty far detached from reality. Maybe some cops read published opinions from their local district and other federal appeals courts, but my guess is that whether somebody knows that something's illegal or not is a little bit more of a broader question than that.
You know, just to follow up on what Beth said too, I mean, this has come out in some awful, awful cases in prisons, for example, kinds of treatment that has been meted out to prisoners. And if you can't find a prior case, then there's immunity. And the thing is, this creates a circle in which there is no relief because there will never be a published opinion with this sort of circular reasoning, right? So court says, well, there's no published opinion. And therefore, we can't give advisory opinions. Therefore, the cop is protected or the prison officials are protected. And you ultimately never get relief. In the beginning, this rule came up about how to apply the reasonable cop, reasonable prison official standard, which is a standard that we use in general litigation, you know, in the private sector. But it's accumulated so much of this nonsensical immunity trappings that at the end of the day, no matter how outrageous the conduct might be, if there is no published opinion, then there's no relief. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy where the courts have gone on this.
You know, I was doing a little bit of research for this program, and I am far from a legal expert. But there was one case that just jumped off the page at me, and this was Jessup versus City of Fresno case. Apparently, the cops were executing a search warrant. They were inside a home and spotted some rare coins, which they stole. And they never denied stealing them. But because there was no prior case like this, the judge dismissed it. And it just seemed to me an example of just what you were talking about, Jim, just how absurd this can be taken.
Actually, it was a business. But the crazy thing was they were executing a warrant for some minor thing, like the business had like a vending machine they weren't allowed to have or something. And the business owners were never actually charged with anything. So here the cops were executing a search warrant on a non-crime that nobody was ever charged with. And then they themselves committed a crime or are alleged to have committed a crime. And yeah, the business owners weren't allowed to recoup any of the money they stole. It was rare coins and it was cash, like hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash.
Wow.
You know, and the Supreme Court just had an opportunity to modify the rule last month, and it refused to do so, left intact the way the rule is. And I think everybody is to the point now where they acknowledge that the courts have gone way too far in trying to establish the balance that they say they want to establish. In reality, it's not a balance at this point. It's a tilt, dramatic tilt in favor of the cops or the officials.
The really fascinating thing here is that there are advocates for law enforcement who say that this is absolutely necessary, that cops are putting their lives in danger every day. And the last thing you want when they're in a dangerous situation is to have to stop and think about whether they're going to be sued, right? That they need to be able to act in a split second way to make decisions because it's the right thing to do and not because they're afraid of their finances. And, you know, I think that that is fair. We do want cops to be able to think on their feet. At the same time, I think what that does is set up a sort of false dichotomy that there's either qualified immunity or there's not. And what I think Colorado is proving is that there's another way. And that is, in Colorado, they recently passed some legislation that holds cops liable for a certain amount of money if they are found to have violated somebody's constitutional rights. I think it's $25,000. And in Colorado, I spoke to a gentleman who runs an insurance company who's now coming up with a personal liability insurance plan for police officers. And so just like a doctor has malpractice insurance, just like, as this insurance gentleman told me, his wife is a marriage therapist. He said, she sits on a couch all day listening to people complain and she has $1 million in personal liability insurance. Officers can pay into an insurance plan that won't break the bank, will protect them if they're sued, but still will take the onus off of taxpayers and will provide some recourse for people if they're wronged by the police. They can sue and then the officer's insurance will pay out. And the really interesting thing about this, what the insurance executive told me, is that because the insurance company is now on the hook, they're going to want to try to come up with some kind of metrics, because this is what underwriters do, for which cops are a bigger risk and which ones are better cops that are not likely to get sued. And so people who have misconduct claims, people who have been sued in the past, they're going to pay a higher premium. And eventually the ones who are really bad cops that are a high risk, they're not going to be able to afford the liability insurance. And so in a way, market forces will actually do the work that our society seems to be unable to do, which is to weed out the bad cops.
I think this is really an important point that Beth is making. There is absolutely no incentive to change police conduct with qualified immunity in place. And using the market forces that we've talked about, you know, if you're a private cop working the mall or something, the insurance company is going to make sure you're trained. And if you have a lot of complaints against you, is going to reject your insurance or make it exorbitantly high. The same principles that we espouse, particularly political leaders, about efficiency, we don't apply when it comes to police. In fact, just the opposite is that there is nothing there that encourages reform of police conduct. You can get the personal policy like Beth is talking about in Colorado. You can get a city policy. It'll have exactly the same effect about enhancing, increasing the police training, because the insurance folks are going to say, you know, if this keeps up, if you don't do this, we're not going to give you the insurance. There are ways to deal with this issue. There are absolutely ways to deal with this issue if the court wanted to do it. And so far, the Supreme Court has been really regressive, to put it mildly, on this issue, you know, such that we have a tremendous amount of injustice going on in the name of protecting law enforcement.
The other thing I will say, and none of us know what the court is thinking, but, you know, some court watchers that I've talked to over the last several months have told me that in general, the Supreme Court is somewhat reluctant to step in where there's an issue that Congress could fix. And, you know, I don't want to give them too much credit for being deferential to the three branches of government, et cetera, et cetera. But it is fair, though, Congress does have the ability to fix this. I mean, the original Civil Rights Act that started this whole thing was written by Congress, and there's nothing stopping them from detailing in legislation what the limits are and aren't of public officials' liability when they do wrong. So I know, for instance, the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act does have a provision that reforms qualified immunity. You know, so far Congress hasn't been able to move the needle on this, but I also want to say it shouldn't and isn't only the court's responsibility to tackle this issue. I mean, the court created this issue. Let's just say that, right? The court created this idea of qualified immunity and dialed it all the way to its current incarnation. But Congress can fix it too.
backing up just a little bit, that Colorado solution is appealing because I think what we're dealing with here is something that's systemic. And at least that solution provides a system, I guess, to keep that in check. So that's a little bit encouraging anyway. And as you point out, yeah, there is actually legislation right now, you know, at the U.S. Congress that could have a major effect in all this. For our listeners, I'd like to cite just a couple of other cases so people get some idea about the depth and breadth of all this. Could either of you comment on Corbett versus Vickers, the case of the Georgia cop that shot a dog but wound up hitting a 10-year-old boy?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. The cop was chasing a suspect through a neighborhood, a residential neighborhood, and happened to run through this family's yard. This family had nothing to do with whatever case the cop was engaged in at that moment. They just happened to be in their yard at that time. And the cop ordered the family to lay down on the ground, which they did, including a 10-year-old who was lying face down on the ground. And apparently the family dog came trotting over as this cop was chasing a suspect, and the cop aimed at the dog and tried to shoot it. The record was mixed on whether the dog was even a threat, but in any case, the cop aims at this family dog, who, again, this family has nothing to do with the suspect he's pursuing, and he missed, and he shot the 10-year-old who was lying face down on the ground. And when the family sued, again, the cop was granted qualified immunity, that he was acting within the scope of his official duties, and he couldn't have known that that would violate the family's constitutional rights. They dismissed it because they said he was covered by qualified immunity, so the case was not allowed to proceed.
Maybe the case that finally broke the camel's back, or one that certainly rose to the attention of readers of the Austin American Statesman, was a piece that you authored about Trent Taylor. Could you give us the background on that case?
Sure. Trent Taylor was incarcerated in prison in Texas in 2013 when he was placed into two prison cells that anyone can agree were just far below the standard of where a human being should have to live. The first cell was coated in human feces from the previous occupant. And the way Trent tells it, and by the way, Texas TDCJ never disputed any of the factual details in this case, the cell was covered. The floor was covered. He said it crunched under his feet when he walked. It was packed into the water faucet. It was smeared on the window. There were paintings out of feces on the wall. The whole place stank of feces. And he was not allowed to leave the cell to eat or drink. So as a result, for 4 days while he was in that first cell, he didn't eat or drink because the water coming out of the faucet was contaminated with feces, and because he feared that his food would be contaminated with feces. Then they moved him from that cell to another cell that had no bathroom. It only had a clogged drain on the floor, which is where all the previous occupants of the cell had relieved themselves. And so the drain was backed up with raw sewage. This cell also had no bed. So not only was he forced to relieve himself in this drain on the floor, but he also was forced to sleep on the floor in the backed up sewage, and he was naked. So for a total of 6 days, Trent Taylor lived in these two filthy cells that weren't fit for an animal. And when he sued his jailers for the psychological damage that resulted, they claimed qualified immunity, that they could not have known that those conditions violated Taylor's civil rights.
I guess it just doesn't get much more egregious than that, you know, short of losing one's life. Now, that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, right?
It did, yeah. Two appeals courts sided with the officers and said, that's right, you are entitled to qualified immunity. There's no case. And the interesting thing was, there was a case that found that it was unconstitutional to house someone in unsanitary condition for months at a time. But there was also a case that said it wasn't unconstitutional to house somebody in filthy conditions for 3 days at a time. And so the lower court said, well, since we don't have a case that delineates clearly whether 6 days is not okay, therefore you get qualified immunity.
So this is another example of the lack of legal precedent.
Exactly. and of the absurdity that this, you know, legal precedent requirement goes to. So finally, it gets up to the Supreme Court. And 20 years, the Supreme Court has literally never sided against law enforcement in one of these qualified immunity cases, not once. Then finally, the Taylor case gets to the Supreme Court, and Taylor had become like a fairly adept jailhouse lawyer at this point. And he knew, you know, he knew the Supreme Court never sides with people like me. The last time they did was in the 90s. And yet they did. In Taylor's case, they said that, yes, it's true, there is no prior case that's exactly on point here, but any reasonable officer should have known that those conditions were not okay. And what they did was they nodded to a case called Hope, which was the last time they had made a finding like this, that there are some conditions that are so egregious that any reasonable officer should have known that they were not okay. Excuse me, I'm wrong. The Hope case was decided in 2002. So that was the last time the Supreme Court said that. And, you know, folks like Jim, who do this kind of work, knew that Hope was out there, but it was almost moribund. It was almost like the court kind of issued its ruling in Hope and then ignored it. And then along comes Trent Taylor and the court, you know, they are humans who live in the United States of America. It is hard to believe that they were not aware of everything that was going on in the wake of George Floyd's death, all of the racial justice protests. I think they realized that they had to do something. But I think, you know, for the reasons we talked about earlier, they were reluctant to make a big, bold change when they knew that what the tea leaf readers think is that they're reluctant to sort of make a change where it's really Congress's job to do that. Hmm. That this was their way of threading that needle, that they reminded the officers in Trent Taylor's case and the lower courts in other cases since then that the Hope precedent still does stand, that there is some police behavior that is so egregious that there doesn't need to be an existing case, that officers just should have known that that's not okay.
Do either of you, Jim or Beth, have a sense about, is this finally the straw that broke the camel's back? I mean, do we think that going forward, there's some hope as a result? Pardon, I'm not citing the Hope case, but there's
hope from Hope. That's what all the lawyers say.
Yeah. What do you think?
I say no. Okay. I mean, this is just so, so egregious.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the court also looks to the media, you know, to see how it's portrayed. Edward, you know, I think the court's very sensitive to this. And this is such an utterly, utterly egregious case, you know, that you can't imagine it could have gone any other way, as the Hope case was. Mm-hmm. But whether it has any long-term consequence, not with this court, not a chance.
Our guest this evening is Beth Schwartzapfel. We're discussing qualified immunity for law enforcement personnel. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. The following is an encore presentation that first aired on July 6, 2021. The segment with Austin Sanders is new and was recorded on March 18th, 2022. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on June 29th. Our guest this evening is Beth Schwartzapfel from the Marshall Project. We're discussing qualified immunity for law enforcement personnel. Let's pick up where we left off.
I like to be a little bit more hopeful than that. I mean, I respect your opinion and I think it's rooted in fact, but I also think shortly after Taylor was decided, the court also sent a case back down called McCoy, where a man incarcerated in prison was pepper sprayed in the face for no reason. This officer was really frustrated with a different gentleman, incarcerated person, but he couldn't get to that guy. So he pepper sprayed this guy named Prince McCoy, who had done nothing wrong. And it's interesting because you hear about these extremely egregious cases where like a cop steals hundreds of thousands of dollars and gets qualified immunity, or shoots a 10-year-old boy and gets qualified immunity. What is the thing that made this case stand out to them? But it did. And they said, no, we just ruled in Taylor that some things are so egregious that they should be obvious. I'm sorry, there's no precedent that says you can't pepper spray someone for no reason, but we think you should already know that. And they sent that case back to the McCoy case. So do I expect this newly reconfigured Supreme Court to boldly go where it has not gone in 20 years and say that qualified immunity has gone too far? No, I don't think so. But I do think we just saw a case just yesterday, actually, where the court is signaling, I think, that in its own piecemeal way, it is listening to the country, that law enforcement does need some additional accountability. So yesterday, the Supreme Court granted cert, and they sent this case back down. It was called Lombardo versus City of St. Louis. And there was a guy who was brought into the St. Louis Police Department. He was brought in because he had failed to appear in court for a traffic ticket, and he was trespassing in a condemned building. So the cops brought him to jail. That's the first thing I just want to pause on. That's what we bring people to jail for in this country. And while he was in jail, he tried to hang himself, and the officers intervened. Let's pause here for a minute, too, because what they did when they intervened was six cops piled on him, handcuffed his hands and feet, pinned him to the ground for 15 minutes until he suffocated and died. And his parents sued the police, who claimed qualified immunity. Now, it's not quite as sort of clear and clean an instance of qualified immunity as these other cases, because it also involved standards of excessive force. It was a little bit more complicated. But in any case, the Supreme Court's looked at two lower court rulings that protected the cops, and they said, no, you need to take another look at this. Again, they didn't issue any sweeping new doctrine. They didn't declare the end of qualified immunity or new use of force standard, but they did say, this needs another look. There are some cases that really where deference to police have gone too far. And that just came down yesterday. So it's a little cause for hope, I think.
So what's going to happen on this, I'm willing to bet $100, is that because the court did this, that when it gets back down, it's going to settle and we're not going to have any precedent. And I think what happens, even though the court is inching in this particular direction, the problem is going to be we still have all of the lower courts. We still have all of the appellate courts to deal with. And unless the court sends a really clear signal, we're not going to have a lot of change in this regard unless you get something that is just extraordinarily egregious. So even though it's hopeful, I think for, you know, when you see some action here by the court, again, I say it's infinitesimal, but is it really going to drop down as precedent or as a hopeful sign for the courts of appeal and for the trial court? To me, it's very worrisome that it changes way, way, way down the line.
We're recording this on Tuesday, June 29th. So much seems to be hitting the news. For example, just yesterday, the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights issued a report. And according to Reuters, at least 190 people of African descent have died worldwide at the hands of law enforcement officials in the past decade, most of them in the United States. Michelle Bachelet, the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights, said that police use of racial profiling and excessive force is entrenched in much of North America, Europe, and Latin America. I mean, at least we're getting some attention to this, you know?
Well, we know how much attention the courts pay to UN reports.
Right. You're not to be swayed at all there, Jim.
No, I mean, you know, theoretically, our Constitution requires us to pay attention, but we don't. You know, there are opinions by Rehnquist saying we don't really need to follow international norms.
You know, Reuters also did a rather extensive investigation just a few months ago, and they noted that the courts are increasingly granting immunity, qualified immunity, or they're citing on the side of qualified immunity, which surprised me a little bit, you know, that even in this age of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, that we're still moving in that direction.
Well, actually, did they analyze data that went as late as that? That investigation blew me away, but I think that the cases they looked at, the timeline ended before George Floyd. I would double check that.
Yeah. And, you know, another case too, very recent, was this whole Lafayette Square incident with William Barr, you know, the attorney general. Didn't the court just rule in his favor, citing again qualified immunity?
I don't know that qualified immunity came into play there. The judge did throw out the suit, but I didn't see where they mentioned qualified immunity anywhere.
Okay.
So, I mean, this actually, Bob, is part of the history of this role. Mm-hmm. And so it really starts out by protecting high-level officials that really don't have day-to-day decision-making in the events that happen. You know, like here, very hard to imagine that Barr is sitting there and directing all of this. Somebody lower, right? So it was to protect these high-level officials. So that's one component. Then, as I say, it's just become a blanket.
That is the case with Pearson versus Ray, right? It was mm-hmm. 15 Episcopal priests. This was going back to 1961. And ultimately, they wound up suing the police and a judge who ruled in favor of the police. And I believe the Supreme Court actually ruled it was the judge who had absolute immunity from liability for damage. Do I have that right?
Yes, that is right. And that's a good example. So, I mean, that makes total sense, right? That a judge has immunity for damages. A judge does not necessarily have immunity from an injunction, yeah. but certainly for damage. It makes total sense. Yeah. That makes absolutely total sense. You can't be suing the judge collaterally, you know, for damages. It would undermine the system. But to take that principle and ratchet it all the way down as it does in Pearson, it begins to say, you know, well, officers got this too, and it's a little bit different, but, you know, this is at common law. It is not at common law. It is for the judges, but it is not for the individual officers. Hmm. But they create this monster that we're living with. I'm a little bit stronger on this, I think, than Beth, obviously. But.
I'm just a reporter, Jim. I'm just here to tell the people what's going on. I'm not here to have any opinions of my own.
No. I think that I have seen on all the litigation I've done, it's just like we run up against this all the time. The absurdity of it. And the problem is that victims don't get compensated. That's the thing that really hurts. You represent people that are beaten or even families, you know, when somebody in their families died.
Oh, yeah. There was that case. I can't remember. It was some Midwestern state or Plains state where this woman had her entire house destroyed. The police threw all these like smoke grenades. They're kind of like stink grenades. The cops threw these like toxic smoke grenades into her home and set off smoke alarms so the entire place was saturated with water. She basically had to move out of her house with her children for months at a time because they were executing a search warrant for an ex-boyfriend that wasn't even in the house. And she was not able to sue for damages. Like, that's one of those cases where it's like the woman really needed the money to fix the mistake that the police made, but qualified immunity meant that she couldn't get it.
I don't like to sugarcoat anything, but maybe to focus a little on areas for hope. You mentioned, Beth, the Colorado case. There was also recently a Civil Rights Act passed in New Mexico, I believe. Do you have any details about that?
I know that it's similar to the Colorado law, but I believe that it had some of the teeth taken out of it in the legislative process. So it's something. I think that it did place some limits on qualified immunity. I'm not familiar with all the details, but I think the Colorado law is stronger if we're looking to like a reform kind of legislation.
Jim, I mean, from your perspective, are we just kind of doomed to a flurry of dueling court cases going forward?
I wouldn't say we're going to be at that level yet. I just think that unless you get some conduct that is extraordinarily egregious, that this rule is not going to change. It's going to stick there. Whether Congress will ever grant any relief is a question, of course. Hopefully, eventually, somebody will devise a rule that works. But we're always subject to what the court's going to do. There is nothing in the Civil Rights Statute 1983 that has anything whatsoever to do with qualified immunity. It's just a construct that the court creates and says, well, it's actually there in common law. This is common law action for all practical purposes. I think this is really something that we have to pay attention to. I'm really grateful to Beth for drawing this out to the public, because I think it's hard for the public to understand how it works and the crazy results that we get from it.
I think if there's going to be reform, we're going to see it at the state level like we did in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you, Jim. I think that if a workable solution emerges from one of these states, that it's likely to spread from there. Because, you know, you see a lot of activism, a lot of mobilized action around police reform and racial justice. And I think it's a lot easier to enact change on a smaller scale. And so if we see these activists applying pressure in other places, Colorado had the death of Elijah McClain, which sparked the reform there. But unfortunately, we see these kinds of egregious cases everywhere. For instance, in New York, efforts to close Rikers Island was sparked by the death of Kalief Browder, the teenager who died after being held in solitary confinement. I think we'll see cases like that spark change on a local level that will spread. I think that's more likely than expecting something as far left as the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act to pass on a national level, given how deadlocked our Congress is.
But alas, we're in Texas.
Well, look, Texas actually has made quite a few criminal justice reforms that puts it way ahead of even blue states on a lot of issues. Like, for instance, New York reformed its discovery laws last year or the year before, and Texas had been a trailblazer in that after the Michael Morton case. I will say, like, yes, Texas is the butt of many jokes when it comes to its criminal justice system, but Texas has been really out front about a lot of criminal justice reforms, and I think it's actually an example to other red states. I guess I'd just like to say that as a reporter, before we even argue about what these folks are doing with our tax dollars and in our name, you know, they're policing the streets to keep us safe. So don't we deserve to know what they're doing?
Well, you know, I think just to follow up on that a lot, the fact that we have iPhones these days has been very important in bringing truth about police conduct and the egregiousness of it. George Floyd's case is but one example. I think that's been really very helpful in the long run.
We really appreciate your time here, Beth, and really want to encourage you to continue this work. It's through the efforts of journalists like yourself that we know about so much of this had remained hidden for so long. So that and all the smartphones out there, as you point out, Jim. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
And Jim, as always, thank you. I know you're retired from this business now, but clearly you still have some passion about this and a lot of interest.
And thanks, Beth, for your good work. It's really important.
Yeah. Oh, thank you too.
It's Friday, March 18th, and once again, we have Austin Sanders with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How are you doing today, Austin?
I'm doing all right. How are you, Bob?
I'm just fine, thanks. I was reading your current article, and it sounds like you're really heading down into the rabbit hole on this one.
Yeah, the rabbit hole of APD officer discipline, when it happens and why it happened. It's confusing stuff.
You know, I thought maybe we'd lead off with just laying the groundwork for all the different organizations that are involved in this matter. Ultimately, we're talking about the racial justice protests of 2 years ago and the charges of excess violence and officer misconduct during those protests. The different players involved, you know, we've got the APD structure with Chief Chacon at the top and his lieutenants and sergeants and officers in the beat and so forth. You know, in addition, within APD, there's a couple other organizations. There's Internal Affairs and there's APA. Could you lay that out a little bit for us?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, there's the Austin Police Department chain of command, the chief at the top, the assistant chiefs below him. The Austin Police Association, which is the union that represents rank and file officers within the department, and they're really active in disciplinary issues. You know, anytime an officer is subject to an internal investigation for their conduct, APA will kind of be there alongside them in meetings when they're allowed to with investigators and whatnot to kind of make sure their rights are being protected as employees of the Austin Police Department. And then there's the Internal Affairs Division, which is an investigative unit inside of APD that is tasked with investigating employees at the department who have been accused of some kind of policy violation or a potential policy violation. So these investigations can be triggered two ways. One is if someone within the department complains about behavior, they suspect that a colleague has committed some kind of policy violation. It could be a supervisor or a subordinate. And then the internal affairs unit will investigate that and then hand over their findings to the chief, who will then decide if, you know, the person subject of that investigation had committed a policy violation. And then if so, there's a discipline matrix, which kind of says if you committed this violation, you should get at least this level of discipline, a suspension, a demotion, an oral written reprimand. It just kind of depends. So that's kind of the internal process of holding officers, you know, accused of wrongdoing accountable when someone breaks a department rule.
So that's all within APD itself. But going back about 4 years, when the union was negotiating with the city came up with this new organization called the Office of Police Oversight, which was the successor of the Office of Police Monitor, which preceded it. Tell us a little about OPO and what is its role in all this?
Yeah, as their name indicates, the Office of Police Oversight, they're an oversight body. They are tasked with helping to ensure, provide oversight of the police department, ensure accountability. So they have a role in disciplinary matters. They're kind of a partner. They participate in investigations. They can participate in interviews, suggest questions that investigators within the Internal Affairs Division ask. But OPO doesn't do their own investigations. They can recommend what type or level of discipline the chief should deliver to an officer. They can't issue their own discipline, right? So they kind of have a limited role or a limited amount of authority in these matters. But one of the critical things they do is, in some cases, publish information related to officer discipline. So if an officer is suspended, for example, for excessive use of force, there's a disciplinary memo that the chain of command writes up, kind of explaining what the officer did, why it was wrong, and what level of discipline they received. And the Office of Police Oversight will publish that on their website for anyone to view. They have a database that's searchable. You can search officer names or detail keywords for incidents to look up this material. OPO's investigative authority is limited, although, you know, the Austin Police Association argues that they still have too much authority and kind of overstep what they're allowed to do in the contract. But that's kind of OPO's role in the internal disciplinary side of officer accountability.
So all of that is directly involved with APD in the city, but then there are other oversight agencies, if you will, the judiciary. And there we pick up both the Travis County District Attorney and the civil courts. So what are their roles in this?
You're right that those kind of accountability bodies through the courts, accountability can be achieved mostly outside of APD, although there is another investigative unit within APD called the Special Investigations Unit. And they are brought in when an employee is accused of criminal behavior. So Internal Affairs investigates policy violations. SIU investigates potential criminal conduct, right? So they'll conduct investigations and then work with the district attorney's office on potential criminal prosecutions. You know, they'll hand over evidence that they've collected. And so the criminal justice system is another way that officers can be held accountable. It's a very high bar to clear to find officers criminally liable, especially in use of force cases. Legal precedent gives police officers, you know, a pretty high threshold in terms of when they're legally allowed to use force. But there's also the civil courts, which has a lower bar to clear to prove that an officer, you know, used excessive force, for example. In the civil court system, you'll have plaintiffs who might file a lawsuit against the city of Austin, the police department, and individual officers, for example, who may have used excessive force. And then these lawsuits can lead to trial through a judge or a jury. A jury will look at the facts the way that a criminal trial will, although often these civil cases will just kind of conclude in settlements, right? Before going to trial, the city will agree to pay a plaintiff a certain amount of money, which is what we've seen with these four settlements from the May 2020 protests downtown. We've had four protesters who were injured during that weekend in May settle with the city of Austin instead of taking lawsuits to trial.
And that's totaled so far about $13 million, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And there are other lawsuits pending. And so that figure will certainly continue to go up.
Thanks so much for laying the groundwork there. We go back to OPO, which fielded over 200 complaints regarding officer conduct during the protests. And those resulted in maybe 20-some internal affairs investigations.
So the Office of Police Oversight forwarded over 200 complaints to internal affairs. So they do a review to kind of say, this incident happened. We believe it's a violation. Internal affairs, you should investigate it. Internal affairs or APD submitted, I think, 21 complaints that were investigated. But the question that I was trying to answer was how many officers were disciplined as a result of their actions during the May 2020 protests outside of APD headquarters? And in December 2020, which about 6 months after that weekend, May 30th and 31st, when most of the violence happened against protesters, the city of Austin issued a statement saying the police chief at the time, Brian Manley, completed his investigation, his review of complaints and critical incidents, and disciplined 11 officers. So that was widely reported by local and national media. It was a big deal at the time. But just a few weeks ago, I learned from APD that actually only one officer was disciplined. An officer who referred to a protester as a gay dude received a 10-day suspension. And 12 other officers received what the department refers to as informal discipline. This can be an oral or a written reprimand or what's known as education-based discipline, which is requiring an officer watch an educational video about their conduct and why it was wrong. But the informal discipline is more viewed as corrective than punitive. So it's not really viewed as a punishment. It's just kind of viewed as kind of like a scolding, you know, hey, officer, you shouldn't be doing this. Don't let it happen again. It doesn't really affect promotions or job transfers in that officer's future. So this is, you know, a pretty big change. 2 years ago, the city saying we disciplined 11 officers, when in reality, only one got a suspension and 11 got, or 12 rather, got this informal discipline, which due to the terms of the police contract that's agreed to between the police association and the city of Austin, we probably will never know why these officers received informal discipline, what they did, the oral written reprimand or education-based discipline. Because basically the contract says if officers commit some kind of policy violation that's below a certain threshold, that's not quite severe, kind of a minor infraction, according to the police department, right? According to the police chief, then they don't have to share that information with the Office of Police Oversight or the public. So these 12 officers who are informally disciplined, we likely will not get the details of what they did to warrant this informal discipline.
This is all so convoluted and strange, it seems to me, where we've got one officer who's suspended for 10 days for a homophobic slur compared with so many others here. And we know from the civil suits that some pretty egregious behavior occurred with these less lethal rounds being fired at, dare I say, point blank range at some of the protesters. I mean, I don't know, this all strikes me as being turned pretty much inside out.
Yeah, I should point out that 19 police officers were indicted on felony assault charges for their actions during the protests. 10 of those have decisions in their internal affairs disciplinary investigations pending. The chief is waiting for the criminal proceedings to conclude before determining if they violated internal policy. And this is kind of standard practice at APD when an officer is accused of criminal behavior as well as a policy violation. They'll wait for that criminal side of things to conclude. So it may well be that these 10 officers will be punished internally for excessive use of force or something like that. We just won't know until these criminal trials conclude.
Wow, it's been almost 2 years now. This sure has dragged out. I suppose the fact that we've got a different police chief now has not speeded things up any, huh?
No, it seems like it hasn't, no.
Yeah. You want to hazard a guess about how long this is all going to take?
We think that maybe some of the trials will begin, if they make it to trial, for these 19 indicted officers, maybe within a year or so. It's kind of hard to say. There's big backlog in the courts system due to COVID-19, but I think about a year before these trials begin is kind of a safe guess.
Well, it sounds like there's still plenty to keep an eye on here, and the city of Austin certainly should be grateful to Austin Sanders for your coverage of this and keeping a close eye on it as it continues to unfold. So thanks so much for your reporting, and we'll hear from you again soon on this, I hope.
Sure. Thanks for saying that. And yeah, I'll be glad to come back and talk about it some more.
That's all for this evening. Stay tuned for the local music mix on the HD3 channel and on coop.org. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you.